Yair Golan is one of the loudest voices in Israeli politics against the extremists of settlers. Formerly, he served in the IDF, Major General, retired actually, in 2018 after 38 years of service. His last role was Deputy Chief of Staff of the IDF. Later on, he joined politics. He formed a party with Ehud Barak. Later on, he moved to Meretz. And now he's on the streets with his, what you call brothers and sisters in arm, fighting against the judicial coup. And I'm really excited to have him here to speak about what is happening, what are the changes that we can see in Israeli society, and what we should expect in the next couple of years. Yair Golan is not only one of the loudest voices today, but he was actually being targeted by right-wingers after in Yom HaShoah of 2016, on May of 2016, he gave a speech saying that he's recognizing the same symptoms that Nazi Germany had within some factions of the Israeli society. That happened after a really severe event when an Israeli soldier, Elor Azaria, literally executed a dying terrorist. Can't say differently, it was a terrorist, but he was executed by an Israeli soldier. At the beginning, Benjamin Netanyahu, he was prime minister then as well, backed up the IDF and the commanders. But later on, because of the pressure from his base of extremists, and since he's being a populist leader, sadly speaking, he shifted against the chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, who's now a member of the Knesset as well, and Bogi Yaalon, who was the chief of staff before and served under Netanyahu as minister of defense. That created a big, big, big clash in Israeli society. It downgraded everything that we're saying about morality and about ethics in the IDF. And that was something that Yair Golan was speaking against. He was bombarded by the right-wingers who demanded that he will be removed from his position as deputy chief of staff. And eventually, even though he was a leading candidate to become the next chief of staff, he was not elected and he actually literally retired. So now he's here with us. I'm really excited to have him here, and let's listen to what he has to say. Welcome to Balagan, Major General Yair Golan, former Deputy Minister of Economic Affairs. How are you?
Well, personally, very fine. Nationally, the situation is quite problematic today in Israel.
And we're going to touch base on both of these issues. I'm really excited to have you here. And we're dealing, as I explained to you in Balagan, we're trying to bring a broader context to our audience about things that are happening in Israel. First, allow me to ask that you'll introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm married to Ruth for the last 36 years. We have five sons and one granddaughter. I'm basically a strong Israeli patriotic person. I was born in Rishon LeZion, played handball, which is not so popular in the United States, and spent much of my time in the youth movement. I joined the military in 1980, 2 years before the First Lebanon War. I fought in the First Lebanon War. I was a paratrooper for many, many years. And in fact, I would say that I grew up in Lebanon because the first 20 years of my service were mainly in Lebanon. I also had a vast experience in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. I fought a lot in my life. I got wounded in Lebanon in 1997 in a skirmish with the Hezbollah. My last assignments in the IDF were the commanding officer of the Home Front Command, of the Northern Command, and then for 2.5 years, the deputy chief of staff. And concerning this assignment, I was responsible much to the military connections between Israel and the United States military establishment. I would like to mention also that I commanded Judea and Samaria for more than 2 years during the implementation of the disengagement plan from 2005 to 2007. And after I finished my military service, I joined the politics. I first went with Ehud Barak, and we tried to establish a new democratic camp. It was not so successful. And then I joined the Meretz party. I serve as a member of the Knesset in 3 consecutive Knesset parliaments, and also as the deputy minister for economics for a year and a half. Unfortunately, too a short time, but it was quite fruitful and quite effective. Right now, I do 2 main things. I protest every day, every weekend, and I try to establish a new political movement in order to change, to take all the lessons I got from the political system and to change the political arena, the political sphere in Israel, in order to do something which will be at the same time fundamental, meaningful, and with much enthusiasm, in order to conscript the masses and to change the course of Israel.
It's interesting because it's not that common. We don't see too many people who are involved in politics or who has been in politics that are actually taking active part in the protests that are going on today. We hardly see the opposition, but we're not going to talk about it today on the streets. But I would love to discuss what is happening, and actually, if you can tell us more, but that's going to be at the end, about the formation of new political structures or organizations in Israel, because I think it's super important, because the game is eventually political. But I want to ask you, so you served in the military in, I would say, the 2 most important fronts that Israel had since the Yom Kippur War, in Lebanon on one hand, in the north, and actually the West Bank in Gaza Strip until the disengagement, of course, throughout your military service. And you served in different eras. So you can definitely see differences between what happened until the Oslo Accords, after the Oslo Accords, and also after the disengagement. And it has been a lot that is going on over there. What can you tell us about what's happening with the Palestinians, what you saw actually between the Palestinians, the settlers, and the state of Israel? Because we're going to elaborate on that in a few minutes.
Yeah, the principles are quite simple. From the very beginning of the Zionist movement in the Holy Land, in the British Mandate, there was this question of, all right, we are coming back to our historical homeland, but we found this land with other people. It's not empty. The Palestinians are there. So what are we going to do with the Palestinians? And I think the Zionist movement struggled with this question from the very beginning. I think that during the great Arab rebellion of 36 to 39, the most prominent Zionist leaders of that time, headed by David Ben-Gurion, came to the same conclusion. We need to separate. And therefore, we got in 47 the partition plan, which was basically the only solution for this complicated situation. I consider the Israeli miracle between 48 to 67, mainly because during that time, we got such a strong, cohesive population, such a well-cohesive citizens. So we were able to gather all human capabilities in order to create something which is almost unbelievable. Very poor country under consecutive threat managed to do something which is almost unbelievable. After 67, in fact, we broke the principles that we held for so many years, that we need to separate ourselves. And since then, Israel is juggling between 2 main principles, separation or annexation, annexation or separation. Unfortunately, for the Zionist religious movement, conquered of Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza Strip was a kind of a divine promise. It was not, you know, just a military wisdom or courageous military activity. It was divine, yes, straight from God.
Yes.
And that was also their way to get some prominent position in the Israeli politics, in the Israeli society. Because right now, you know, since 67, they are the one who lead the Zionist camp, who take the Zionist dream to the other phase, to the new sphere, to a sphere where earthly activity with divine vision gather together, merge together in some sort of a biblical manner. And this is for a person who believes in God. Oh, this is a kind of a fantastic vision that put in your heart so much enthusiasm. And this is great. You know, this is something to fight for. The only problem with this vision is, well, it's easy to implement such a vision in the Golan Heights. Why? Because we found the Golan Heights after the Six-Day War empty. Basically,
barely populated.
Except, yes, yeah, except, you know, for Druze villages, empty. But unfortunately, we found Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip full of Palestinians. And basically, for the first 20 years, we ignored them. They weren't exist until the first Intifada erupted in 1987, late 1987. And since then, after each crisis, after the first Intifada, and then after or during the second Intifada, we came to the same solution. We need to separate. So each time we have a military crisis, a security crisis, we come to the same conclusion. No other way to solve the problem but to separate ourselves from the Palestinians. But right now, after we managed to implement the disengagement plan, but it was, you know, halfway, it was not a complete solution. What we got instead is a strong right-wing government that, in fact, want to annex 2.8 million Palestinians in Judea and Samaria and 2.1 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, which is a complete craziness. It's the end of the Zionist project, the end of the Zionist dream. It could impose a complete destruction on Israel, and people still call them the national camp. They are not. They are not Zionists. I do not consider them as a true Zionist, and I do not consider them as a true national camp. In fact, the camp that oppose this lunatic thought about annexation is the more nationalistic camp. If you want to separate...
National, not nationalistic. Nationalistic
yeah.
is them.
You are right. We are the true national camp. You are right. Because we do understand that only by separation, only by starting some sort of reconciliation process, we will be able to reach this two-state solution, living side by side peacefully. This is the ultimate vision. And we need in Israel, you cannot live without a true national vision.
Eventually, Ben-Gurion, when you mentioned him earlier, when he yes. said yes to the partition plan, he did it because he wanted to ensure that we will have a strong and sustainable Jewish majority over the parts of the lands where we're going to establish the land. And yeah. what's happening now is that literally the messianic ultra-right wing who's leading the country at the moment, when they're offering to annex the West Bank and Gaza Strip, is to literally make the state of Israel a binational state.
There is no ability to sustain such a binational state. And I can tell you more than that. you cannot reach, you cannot impose on the Israeli civilians such a solution, but by dictatorship-like regime. Because Israel, as long as it remained democratic, liberal democratic state, the majority oppose this annexation. Therefore, what we see today in Israel, all the protests, that in fact people go out at least every weekend in order to save this government. We want to save our democracy. We want true, honest leaders, and we want a sustainable solution to the Palestinian question. There is no way we will be able to annex millions of Palestinians and still remain a homeland for the Jewish people.
So you said that the people have woken up, and I actually want to take us back to 2016, when you were still deputy chief of staff in the IDF, and you gave a speech. It was the evening of the Holocaust Day. It was the National Memorial Day of the Holocaust in Israel. In Hebrew, they called it Ne'um HaTa'alichim. But you were talking about progress that was made in Germany in the 30s, and that you see a lot of similarities to things that were happening in Israel at that time. When you gave this speech, I remember that it was considered to be super controversial. People demanded that you will be
fired from
your position. And of course, it was another Netanyahu government, because we have Netanyahu for such a long time that it's hard to remember when he wasn't prime minister. What made you give this speech in this place? And how do you explain the fact that 7 years ago, people refused to see what you saw? And now we can say that a lot of people are actually saying he got a point.
Yair Golan Sadak.
Yeah.
Yair Golan was right in English, yes. I would say that because I was so close to the government, so close to Netanyahu, as a deputy chief of staff, your presence in so many meetings, and I heard him and others, and I look at the way they conducted the most sensitive security issues of Israel, and it was devastating. I saw it. It was not something, well, that was hard to identify. I was the only one who spoke up. And I think, you know, today I was right. I was right in speaking up, because when you see it, you need to speak up. Because what are the lessons we take out of history? We ask ourselves, why Europe, the most advanced continent in the world, back then in the 20s and the 30s, why there was such a fascist strong movement all over Europe, encompasses, you know, most of Europe? Why? Don't we understand that even the most liberal, the most advanced nation could deteriorate in a very short time? Very short time. Look, the Nazi regime was in Germany only for 12 years. That's not the whole story. 12 years. In 12 years, they impose on the world such a huge destruction. I have no intention to say that what we have in Israel is exactly or even similar to what was happened in Germany. No similarities. But I look at the process. I look at the origins. I look at populism as a very strong phenomenon, which, you know, could change the course of nations. I look at corruption and what is the influence on a nation. I look at messianic approach. No matter whether you believe in communism, fascism, or, you know, Nazism, or any other ideology or religion, I look at the strength, at the influence, and the ability to convince so many people to do terrible things. And therefore, I think mainly because we are Jewish, we need to take the right lessons out of history. And we need to say, we are the Jewish people. We need to bring to the world goodness. We need to correct the world. And we should say to the rest of the world, and mainly to ourselves, no place for racism in Israel. No place for dictatorship in Israel. No place for corruption in Israel. That's what we need to show the rest of the world. And that's the reason why the Jewish state should exist in this problematic area of the world. We have a mission, and our mission is to bring good for the rest of the world. And we cannot do it by violating any human standard, any human values. So we need to keep them as strong as possible. And we need to show the way to other nations. That's the way I understand the Jewish history. That's my vision for the state of Israel. And that's my vision for the whole Jewish people.
I want to connect what you said now, and actually your speech from 2016, to the tahalichim, to the processes that we started seeing just before. You gave the speech, I think it was May of 2016 that year.
May 2nd or 3rd, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And in March of 2016, there was the case of Elor Azaria, a soldier in Hebron, who literally executed a dying terrorist instead of taking care of him when he was a medic. And this case of Elor Azaria actually created a shift in, I would say, the Israeli discussion. Because at the beginning, Prime Minister Netanyahu backed up the military. He backed up, at that time, the Minister of Defense, who was Bogi Yaalon, and he backed the commanding officers. And then something happened there. What happened?
Well, this is populism. It got a lot of pressure from the right, from the extreme right. He got a sense that according to what is moving in the social media, that a lot of people tried to see, you know, Elor Azaria as their own soldier, you know, as their own son. And as a populist leader, and Netanyahu is no doubt a populist leader, he took this popular feeling and tried to make out of it some political profit. This is the issue. And it's so sad. It's really sad because it was so easy to remain cool and to show the way and to say something like the following, all right, something wrong was happening, and therefore I leave this issue to the inquiry of the military echelons, and I trust the military commanders to conduct this issue the most sensitive and just manner. And that's it. That's it. And if someone from the far right trying to stab you in the back because he's the son of us, he was a soldier, he fought for us, and all these populist sayings, you should tell him, shut up. Come on. We are the IDF. We keep our soldiers moral. And by keeping them this moral standard, we provide them something which is so precious for the rest of their life. Something that a true leader would say, but not in this case. And Netanyahu is not a true leader. He's a populist, he's weak, he's much weaker than it seems to be from the outside. He takes any political threat as a huge threat, and therefore is not stable, and therefore is willing to serve, not just because of judicial problems, all kind of lunatic agendas, because he's not able to stand for his principles. This is the story of Netanyahu, and it's truly very sad for Israel, because right now, with corruption and with his judicial problems, is very, very dangerous.
You were talking about the morals. I can tell you, I already lived in the US and I was working with college students at that time. And a lot of the workshops I was doing was around ethics and the IDF, because we always say that the IDF is the most moral army in the world, right? And then came the Elora Azaria case. And it was really hard to justify what was happening. And I always say that in many ways, the right wing in Israel is providing so much bread, so much food to the BDS movement and to Israel's haters. Exactly. When you see what's happening even now in Hawara and in the West Bank, okay, for us as Jews, I don't see any way that we can justify what's happening. But I think that the Elora Azaria case was a really hard turning point when suddenly Netanyahu himself, who portrayed himself.
I agree with you. I think it's a true turning point. And I can tell you that I wouldn't make this speech in the Holocaust Day without the case of Elora Azaria. That's for sure.
So I want to go to the IDF today and to today's Israelis. Because one of the biggest motivations for people to go out to the street and protest was in March, when Netanyahu said that he's going to fire the Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, because Yoav Gallant received a lot of backlash from what the right wing is calling now refuseniks, but actually from reserve volunteers, who said that if the judicial overhaul is going to happen, they will stop volunteering to the IDF. Can you shed some more light about what was happening and what is happening now with the IDF? What does it mean? I mean, you know, for the IDF, those volunteers will not come.
Netanyahu's judicial reform, in fact, tore up the IDF. And it's an ongoing problem. People army, the meaning of people army is that, you know, everyone serve, or many, many of us still serve as active soldiers or reserve soldiers, doesn't matter. And you are willing to serve because you have some sort of a contract with the government. You ask us to put our life in risk. You ask us to fight for your policy. Therefore, we need to make sure that this policy was the right policy, that the process was conducted in the most democratic manner, that yes, there is a strong legitimacy, internal legitimacy to your policy, to what you want to do. We have no intention to interrupt in the process, but we want to make sure that the rules of the game are well kept. And what is happening right now in Israel, the government broke up the contract between the government and the citizens. And citizens say to the government, we have no intention to serve you anymore because we do not believe in this government anymore because you broke up the contract. You are not willing to keep the democratic rules. You did something wrong to the state of Israel, and we have no intention to cooperate with your activity. No intention. And I think this is, well, they are not deserters. They are the most patriotic Israelis who are willing to risk their future to go forward against the government because they believe that if you are a patriotic Israeli person, you need to keep liberal democracy in Israel as strong as possible. And any other kind of regime, well, will be wrong for the destiny of Israel. Israel is such a diverse society. We came from 70 countries around the globe. We have a huge Arab population in Israel. 21% of the population. To put all these people together, you need a very strong democracy based on very liberal principles like equality. And this government took all principles, all values, and smashed them. So we are going to protest, and we are going to rebel, and we are going to say no, no, no to this government.
What at this point is fueling the veterans more? The fact that the coalition may continue, probably will, because we see that Netanyahu is now playing with Benny Gantz again, that they will continue with the judicial overhaul. The fact that in this upcoming seat of the Knesset, the ultra-Orthodox are demanding to release or to ban the ultra-Orthodox from being drafted, or the fact of what's happening in the West Bank, you know, with the settlers. We just saw a couple of days ago, now a member of the Knesset, Zvi Sukkot, saying that he went to Joseph's tomb in Shechem, and he is grateful for the soldiers that are keeping them. Well, there is a strong debate whether Joseph is actually lived there, son of Jacob, of course.
Yeah.
What do you think is fueling the veterans more, or the public sphere more?
I think it's all together. It's all together. It's really hard to know what is the exact motivation of each citizen, of each person. It's all together. And I think that most of us, most of the normal Israelis, you understand that, come on, you cannot move forward with a modern, flourishing, prosperous country while at the same time combine together corruption and some sort of religious fundamentalism with a messianic approach which is in a total disconnection to reality. This is the issue, you know, and people understand that. I try to convince some of the leaders of the protests that, look, we need to put three flags in front of our nose, not just, you know, save democracy. It's not just about democracy. It's about the reasons why there are factions in the Israeli society who want to destroy democracy. And the three main motivations, from the less prominent one to the more prominent one, is first, the willingness of the ultra-Orthodox to strengthen their autonomy. The second thing is the willingness of mainly the Likud party and also other parties to take as much as possible money, budget from the public, I don't know how to say
to
it.
To loot, I would say
treasury.
To loot.
Yeah, for
public
treasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the third issue is the willingness of messianic faction in the Israeli government and the Israeli society to annex millions of Palestinians, which is, you know, again, a crazy thing to do. So this is the issue, and therefore it's not about the judicial reform. The judicial reform is more a symbol. But it's not the true issue which really tore the Israeli society right now.
You're mentioning the rallies and the protests on one hand, and you were talking about equality. You were a part of a coalition that seemed to be impossible and eventually proved itself to at some point to be impossible. But it was the first coalition that actually set some, I would say, new standards for collaborations. It was the first coalition that actually had such a broad variety of parties, from the right wing of Tikvah Hadasha, led by Gideon Saar and Avigdor Lieberman of Israel Beitenu, all the way to Meretz, that you are a member of Meretz. And actually, for the first time, Israel actually had an Arab party
as a member,
official member, who signed a coalition agreement.
Yes.
Do you think that it's going to be doable in the future to make such collaborations?
I would say the following. I think that what we see right now is a rearrangement of the Israeli political system. It won't be anymore according to right and left national camp against the peace camp or against the Smolanim Bogdim, you know, the traitors from the left.
As they were portrayed by the right wing, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Not anymore. Course. This is a time to rearrange and rebuild the Israeli political system. And in this political system, anyone who has a strong democratic liberal sense, anyone who wants to enhance equality in Israel, anyone who wants to fight for the security of Israel in a well-established and recognizable borders by the rest of the world, all these people can be part of the same party, part of the same coalition. It's a time for much more cooperation between Arab population and Jews. It's a time for saying something new about the relationship between periphery and center in Israel. It's a time for saying, you know, something new about what are the rights, what are the duties, and what are the opportunities we provide each young citizen in Israel. So yes, there, we know we, each crisis, we have also new opportunities. And I think this is, I look at that as my main mission today, to figure out what are the opportunities out of this crisis and to work hard in order to take these opportunities and do something which is positive, fruitful, and full of hope for the destiny of Israel.
There is one thing that I think that you understand well, and also other leaders of the protests at the moment, and that eventually the game is not just on the streets. It's also in the political arena. So do you think, I mean, in 2011, we had huge protests in Israel over the economic crisis, but eventually it didn't create a lot of change. Do you think that we are going to see a political transition and a growing involvement of the general public, I would say, the seculars who went in major numbers, I would go, to the private sector and left the education system to others and the military and the police force and all of the public sphere that was abandoned, I would say, by the seculars? Do you think that we're going to see a change now?
I'm sure that the answer is yes. Not everything will be exactly according to our expectations.
Of course.
But no doubt that we will see in the next coming years much more involvement of the majority of the secular Jews, of the liberal Jews, of the free Jews who live in Israel in order to reestablish the Zionist spirit, to reestablish the Israeli spirit, to bring something which is absolutely right and just. And that's the ability of every young citizen in Israel to get normal education, good education, reasonable health care, all other civil services, and at the same time, keep Israel safe and secure concerning external threats. This is the vision, this is the mission, and well, it's not so hard to do as long as you reach some national new agreement. And we need today a national new agreement between us, mainly between the Jews in Israel, but it should include also the Arab population. And we need this vision, you know, this agreement and this vision to be positive, to be something with a promise, something which is optimistic. And we need it today more than ever before, really, for more than ever before, because the threat is so high, the risk is so high, and we can do it. It's not some sort of external threat that you have no ability to influence that. In this case, we can influence our destiny in a very prominent manner. Again, it won't be perfect, But I think that there is no other way but to enhance Israel as a democratic, liberal state, and at the same time, the homeland of the Jewish people.
And do you think that at the moment, is it doable to have this sort of agreement with the populist Likud and what's called religious yes. Zionism today yes. and the ultra-Orthodox? You know,
yes, we are in front of a crisis, and a crisis is not something nice to have, but every crisis is also an opportunity. My personal task is to build something positive out of this crisis. That's the way I consider my role in the Israeli political arena. And we need to work hard with many, many, many others in order to do it. And I would like to finish this discussion, you know, by saying that, yes, we can. I know it's not original, but yes, we can. We can change the course of Israel. We can make Israel liberal democracy. And at the same time, the homeland of the Jewish people, a free and equal state for all its citizens. So help us God.
And I will say amen to that. Yeah. And with that, we will conclude. I just want to thank you very much, Yair Golan, Deputy Chief of Staff of the IDF, former member of the Knesset. It was a pleasure having you here, and I really hope that you're going to be back in the public sphere in another meaningful role.
As soon as possible.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this opportunity. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.